women are more likely, in fact, not that they're more likely, in Africa, women, 95% of a woman's income goes back to the family. While for the men, only about 45 to 50, if I remember clearly, goes to the family.
Oh, wow.
Especially low income. And I actually know why, because I entered those communities.
Born and raised in the motherland, chasing a better life, story of an immigrant.
Concrete pastures.
Concrete pastures.
Concrete pastures.
Hello, family. You are listening to Concrete Pastures Podcast. I am Nancy Mulemwasisi. Thank you so much for tuning in today. For anyone who is new on our platform, this is a space that allows myself and others to share our stories as we deconstruct the world's view of an immigrant status. We unlock the joys, the laughs, and the bravery that being a dreamer brings. So subscribe, like, share, and stay a while as we dive into today's episode. Oh my God. For those of you that truly know me, you know, a lot of the times I'm led by God to bring certain people, and this woman is one of those people, and I'm so blessed and honored to have her on today. She shared her story on one of the platforms I was on, and she's on also 55 Faces, and prior to that, I was also introduced to her by my girl Mo Sibo, who's been on this platform. She has her own platform, Mo Sibo Podcast. Guys, this is a must-listen episode on Mo Sibo. It's numbered episode 33, and the name of the episode that they did together with her sister Mo Sibo is Trials and Triumphs for Secondary Infertility. This is a must-listen. But today she's here to share her story, the other side of her story as well. And without further ado, our girl, her name is Funmi Okubanjo. She is a remarkable individual who brings together a unique blend of passion and expertise from her 15-year journey across diverse industries. She holds a certification as a development finance analyst and a project management professional, PMP, demonstrating her commitment to excellence in her field. Umi's fearless approach to converting business strategies into profitable operational plans set her apart as a leader. Her boldness defines her leadership style, allowing her to make a lasting impact through her social enterprise, Radiant Futures. Through Radiant Futures, Funmi is dedicated to improving the lives of underserved communities with a particular focus on financial inclusion and women economic empowerment. So far, Radiant Futures has successfully served over 200 micro-businesses of low-income women in Lagos, Ogun, and Oyo states in Nigeria. Welcome, my sister. How are you?
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you so much. Thank you for bringing me here. Yeah.
Oh my God. I love your resume. It's so full.
Oh.
And this is just a little bit of what you have done. I just wanted to share a little bit of who you are. And first, I mean, we start by knowing where you are. I know you're joining me from Nigeria. Our time difference is 6 hours, right?
Six hours.
So it's evening for you and two morning for me. Yeah, I love it. When I do these, I love the international time difference. It's just giving people some perspective. It's like we have immigrants all over the world and people who have experienced immigrant life all over the world. But just to get to know you a little bit, how was it growing up in Nigeria?
Okay, so I always try to accept the fact that I take it that growing up was privileged. That's the reality. Someone will hear the story and feel it wasn't. But for me, I say it's privileged because I now understand why that was my upbringing. So I'll say, no, that's a beautiful upbringing. So growing up, I grew up in a polygamous home. We're 14 kids, 7 boys, 7 girls. Yeah, we have an internal house joke. So even though my siblings will hear this, they know the joke. We used to tease my dad and say, oh, 14 plus X. And we used to say, it's where when my father dies, it's late now, I've passed away more than 10 years now. When my father dies, that all the ex will be revealed onto us and we know. So I'm Muslim home. So yeah, I was okay to marry more than one wife. I was number 12, or I am number 12 of the 14 kids. So growing up was, you had everybody ahead of you trying to set the standard, and you constantly just feel like, oh my God, am I going to do well enough? Am I going to match up to every barrier that's been broken ahead of me? Now, to my mom, we're three girls. So in a polygamous home, and then your side, you're all girls. Usually you'd be like, where's the boy? So every time you're having an ex child, or every time she was having an ex child, the question was like, hey, maybe it's to be boy. And you know, she used to desire it, like, I wish it was a boy. But yeah, we ended up all being girls. And a lot of stuff my mom used to say. I would also say growing up was interesting. And I say interesting because early part of my life, I saw my father in wealth, you know, some sort of wealth. I would say for that time, we were doing very well because we were growing up during the military regime. And my father was fortunate to have worked with the federal government, and he had to drive a lot of infrastructural developments. And of course, there was significant funding as much as the military government allowed, but they dictated where projects we go to. And I remember I was just moving into the next class and everything scattered. My dad got on the wrong side of our then military administrator of my state, and they went on national TV to fire my father. So we didn't even hear the gist at all. Like, we watched the news, and he just said on news that it was all drama. Like, the guy walked into my father's office and just called my father's name and said, you're fired, you're dismissed. And the next thing, wow. Assets frozen, nothing. My older sibling had to suddenly take on responsibilities they were not prepared for, because it was just, you were here and then you just dropped flat. Because when they tell you that a military administrator froze your assets, it means like everything is suddenly gone. So you woke up, you had money, and then you go to bed and you have the money, but you can't have it. And they're telling you, oh, you just can't have it. So that was the beginning of my own teenage years. Wow. So I'll say it was a big shock. It was a big shock. I think it was important. That's where I see now. Like, it was important that happened. It was frustrating. It was painful. I remember vividly that I sat on the stairs in my house, and because I was about to enter secondary school, and it was an expensive secondary school, and we're literally weeks away from resumption, and I sat there, and I knew my father had not paid our fees at that time. You know, I sat on the stairs and I was asking myself, would we be able to go to school? Because even though I was 9+, I understood what it means when the military administrator says you're done. Everything goes with you. Everything goes down with you at the same time. So yeah, it was tough. It was suddenly tough.
So wait.
Yeah.
Oh wow. I'm just curious, and I'm sure some of our listeners would be curious. How is it growing up with 14, like among 14 siblings, like 13, since you're the 14th, so 13 siblings?
So it depends on how you see. So one, everybody was not in the house at the same time. So just look at it, like you have decades of gaps between you guys. So then the few of you that also, literally when I was growing up at all, I would say I had like 4 or 5 of my older siblings in the house at that time. My other siblings were either in university. So you see, they were not really in the house with us. But just generally knowing that you have this number of older siblings ahead of you, for me, it puts a pressure on me to perform. Because if the question was always, who will stand out? And then when you're growing up in a polygamous home, you're competing for attention as a child. You know, because if you say, for example, you want to focus on STEM, somebody already focused on STEM. If you say you want to focus on, like, you just ask yourself, I want to be the best in this house in sports. Maybe somebody barely doing it to the house. So the biggest thing for me was, I think it's in my home that the desire to be exceptional started. So it was just like the other person has said, you know, that your older sibling, they finished with this kind of grade in high school. Then what about you? Oh, they did this in university. What about you? So that was always the question. And I just remember that all the siblings before me, so the 12 kids before me were mostly science. So they studied like science-related courses, engineering-related courses. And by the time I was going to start preparing, so here in Nigeria, from what you call year 9, year 10, you pretty much already kind of know what you focus on. Yes. So I was going to go otherwise and say, okay, no, I want to do the business or social sciences. It was a bit weird because the first question was, who in this house does that? You know, it was not. And then in Nigerian, because I'm Nigerian, you're either a doctor, you're either an engineer. So what is it? Or you become a professor. So if you choose academia as your path, you better be a professor. Or you're an engineer, or you're a doctor, or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So the other, yeah, so it was really the same. And it was usually intense. It was intense because you're competing for resources. Yeah. As much as you compete for attention, you also compete for resources. So I guess I also taught us how to negotiate, right? So you have to learn how to defend your own budget. So I remember when we're going to school and we write a list of items we need and you do the cost breakdown. As teenagers, we had to do that. If you give it to my father, he would try to strike it up and say, you don't need it. And because he had to go through maybe three of us budget like that, and it will strike off. So you have to get smart and say, oh, this is why I need it. If you say she's not going to get it, this is why I must get it. And not that I laugh about these things, in those phases of our life, sometimes it felt traumatic. That's the truth, because you just feel a sense of scarcity, like it's not enough. And yes, thinking is not enough in terms of resources. There's also a part of you that's thinking you are not enough as a person, because you're always saying, how better can I be than the other person that's going ahead of me? So it's always a deli. And I'm laughing about it now.
I am, it was going through my mind is how, like, Nigeria is very populated, that aside from competing with your siblings, you have to also compete with the rest of the world. I can't imagine going through that. That is wow. I never even thought about it that way, that you actually compete through your with your siblings, and then from there you also have to compete with the rest of the world. Wow.
So the way I would see it is, okay, so when the competition starts at home for you, where I see it now, I think it just prepares you for the toughness of the society that you're born into. So if you can, so that's just the way it is, and it really works that way because we're competing at home. Mm-hmm. I have my half sister who is just like a year or 2 years older than me, and I have my younger sister who is just like a year old, younger than me. So literally you are just, all of you are the same age, probably just 1 year apart in terms of grade. Yeah. So because we're already at that level, you are competing amongst yourself, then when you get into the society, you're not afraid, you're not confused. The game already started at home. So you don't say, they're like, oh, this is how this place is. Okay, I can do this. I've seen what, let's do it. You know, so that's what it does to you.
You just become an overachiever, I guess.
Yes. Which sometimes has to, you know, it's not always the best way to go, because you're consistently asking yourself that you're good enough.
Yes. Trust me, even for people who haven't grown up in like your situation, it's tough because you're constantly not good enough. I don't know if you guys have shared it on your episode, that to other people, you're never gonna ever be good enough. Yeah, I think you shared it on there, which is I think profound, because to other people, you're never gonna be good enough. Even to your siblings, there's always gonna be something that they see. It's like, oh, there's something wrong here. They look at your life, it's like, what's wrong with you?
Sometimes it's like people are digging for what is wrong with you because they want to use it to validate what they believe is wrong with themselves.
Oh, 100%. I'm a firm believer of that. So, my dear, how have you been able to come out of that? Because there's a lot of people, polygamy is a normal thing in Africa and in America, in some parts of America, there's also polygamy here as well. And I'm sure there's a lot of people experiencing what you've experienced growing up. And there's little kids, you know, there could be parents that are listening that can be able to guide their children in a way that they don't feel less than or not good enough as they're growing up. And also maybe an awareness to parents that are in polygamy to be able to share that attention to their children, or even to that dad that has that many wives to be able to allocate his attention differently. Because I have two. I don't even know how. Some days I don't feel like I'm giving my son enough attention, I'm giving my daughter enough attention. So could you share in your own way on how you can overcome that?
Oh, so truth is, one, I've been through therapy. That's what I'll say.
Okay.
I've been through therapy. The other thing is, coming to faith helps. now. So I'm a Christian, and over the years, coming to understand that the image God has of me is the image Christ given me, and that is good and perfect. So there's a lot of mind work that also goes into it. You know, like I remember something I didn't tell Alice shared is when we're growing up, because of the competition at home, my mom used to say, be like seven men. And she started saying those things to us as girls because she didn't have a boy. Mm-hmm. And wanted it to be clear. She wanted to make a statement to the world that my daughters are equal to seven men. Now, it has its flip side because, again, it just puts that overachiever mentality, just drills it into your bone marrow and it's right there. But for me, just realizing that God has his place and plan for me, has his purpose for me, there's a way God sees me, and that's what really matters. The other thing is, so when you grow up in polygamy and you come to the faith, because, you know, the way we see God, it's similar to the way we perceive our fathers. So it can, for a while, it's going to take your mind time to adjust. But something I remember that as much as I grew up in a polygamous, or my dad did, was my dad actually treated each child as unique. When in my father's sight, we're not the same. Mm. In my father's sight, it was also always very hard to know my father loved the most. He had 14 kids, and you, if my eldest brother should hear this, if all was argue that, oh, because he's the one. But it was very hard for you to say this is the person my father loved the most, because my father's philosophy in the house was that of a specialist. My father's thesis was consistent. He would say things like, oh, if my mom asks me to cook, because I do not like cooking, my father would say things like, she doesn't like cooking. She would rather sweep. So why don't you let her sweep? Why are you forcing it on her that she must also be able to cook? So my father brought a perspective of uniqueness, which when I came to faith, it was easy to see. So what I would say to parents is, you already have those kids, as many as they are, or those children already in that situation. One parent, it would be nice to help each, it would be nice for you to see and acknowledge the uniqueness in each child and validate it, actually say it to them. Actually let them know that, okay, yeah, you guys are many, but you don't worry, you're different. Oh, you're different. It helps the psychology of the child. Mm. Now, for a kid growing up in that environment, you have to understand that sometimes that environment is creating a foundation for what lies ahead, most of which you do not even know. It's tough to accept it's a blessing, but if your mindset to it is, I'm already here, I didn't choose this family, I was born into it, I'm just going to survive it and make the best of it and use it as leverage, use it to understand. So because I grew up in a large home, for example, I find it easy to just connect with people. It just comes natural, because when you grow up in a large home, it's very hard for you to seclude yourself from the group. Mm. You probably don't even have a room to yourself. You have to share a room. Yes. So your mind is constantly, you're just open. It has this flip side, you know, you're constantly, you don't know to put the boundaries in place. But I'll say to anyone who grew up in that environment and is struggling to accept it, to say, one, just accept that is the family you've come into. Now look at it and realize that you will never know the importance of that family until you leave. Until you go into a new family or you grow older and you're out of the home, then you just see why it was there. So for me, the mindset is, try to see some good. So either you try to see some good in your siblings, you try to see some good in your parents. Till now, my siblings, even my house siblings, I'm not sure you can always convince me like to not to like them. It's just so hard because I remember my other siblings were the ones who had to pay our fees. They supported me in my education. So right from year 9 till I finished from university, the oldest 2, 3, 4 siblings had to take on our educational fees. And they were not born to my mom. They were not my mom's children. Yeah. But they took that up. So that might be unique to us. That might be a blessing. But the core message is the family sets the foundation for life's purpose and life's journey. And most times, we never know or understand it while we are there. But it would all make sense. So just embrace it. Enjoy. Don't resist the tide. Just flow with the tide. It will all lead somewhere good. You have to maintain a very optimistic view and say, as long as I don't like how I feel, as much as this feels tough, I hate it, something good has to come out of all of this. It just, this experience had to be utilized for something greater than me at the end of the day. Yeah.
Well said. You went to school in Cape Town.
Yes, I did.
Why come back to Nigeria?
Going to Cape Town was passion journey.
Gotcha.
It was passion journey, passion for Africa. So again, something my father did very well was to put a love for community in us. My dad taught us that we were not, you had not achieved greatness if you were not serving your people. So in the midst of all the drama he experienced with the military government, for example, and the situation was, it was funny, whenever I tell people they laugh, the sole reason for dismissal was because he had a counter project plan to the military administrator's desire. So you were dreading road constructions, and my father insisted roads had to be extended into the rural communities along the highway, because he felt if you do that, it just made sense, right? We're opening all of those spaces up for development.
Yeah.
But for one reason or another, the then administrator insisted on, tribalism and every other reason that you can give here. Don't extend here, only extend here. And he went against the instruction, and he told his project team and all the guys, make sure it extends. If I come on site and visit, I want to see that. So the sense was always, so because he did that, and for me, that consistently stands up. I'm never ashamed of the story, because for a lot of kids, that thing is, it's like you were well known and suddenly you're like, yeah, it's like they've locked you up somewhere. So for me, my father put that sense of, be ready to die for what you believe is right. Be ready to lose for what you believe is right, as long as it serves a communal good. Now, the whole thing of communal good also helps, because when you grow up in a large family, after a while, you learn to let go of what you want on your own budget so that your younger sister can have it. So it also, you see, everything sums up. So going to South Africa was me just, it was passion of Africa. How can we develop the continent better? And there was a course they had called development finance. And I had the option of going to University of Manchester in the UK. And then for some reason or other, I think I lost my dad around that time. Then Cape Town opened up and he said, well, dad, they have the same course there. And I told myself, okay, why go to the West to learn about Africa's development? Just sit in class with the Africans and you guys talk about it yourselves and figure it out. So that's how I ended up in Cape Town, Garden School of Business, UCT, University of Cape Town, Garden School of Business. Beautiful place. If you've been to Cape Town, Cape Town is beautiful.
I plan to retire. That's why I've been asked.
Yeah, so my school is at the waterfront. So you can actually like get a good feel and just like, okay, no, I can live here for the rest of my life.
Love it.
That experience helped. Then South Africa is Africa. So to just be like, you know, why you stay there? Just come back to Nigeria. Just stay full time in Nigeria. You're good. And nice. I also had a job while I was in on the boat. It just made sense to stay back here.
Nice. So tell us about your social enterprise, Radiant Futures. How did it come about? And what are the goals and impact that you aim to achieve with the initiative?
So it's an idea that came from a class while I was in Cape Town. So we had a course called SRI, Social Responsible Investment, something like that. Mm. Or Socially Responsible Investment. And it's along the school of thought of impact investment, pretty much. That's what we'll call it today. And in class, I had quite a number of classmates, young Africans who were there, and just, you're just sharing ideas. Oh, this is what we can do. You can invest in this kind of entity so that you can create this kind of impact. And for the first time, I was in a room where people talk about investment, not strictly from a return on investment perspective, but they're saying, no, oh, you're going to have environmental impact, what's the social impact? I was like, wait, I thought we're all here to make money. What, you know? And then finally, I'm seeing, oh, so you're telling me we can do business in a way that translates not just to profits and not just to massive assets on your balance sheet, but you're saying we can do business in a way that we are reducing poverty, which is the biggest challenge we have here, right? So I was there and I just kept on asking myself, okay, I love poor people. I've always worked with low-income households since university. I've worked with kids from low-income households. Okay, what else can I do? What do I know? So I had a thesis and to the question, how can we improve the lives of low-income households? That was the question. And I started just telling myself, okay, what do I know that can help me address the problem? And then I said, okay, I understand knowledge, skills. If people have knowledge, skills on something, then they'll be able to do that thing. And I said, okay, what's the other thing? Capital. If they have the resources, then if they have the funding, they can do something. So I started some sort of small scale impact fund, and I came back, I was also going to rural communities. I was also working in school at the same time. I was going to rural communities, just see, okay, what's going on here? What's the predominant social economic activity? Just curious, like, okay, mama, what can we do? You know, you speak the native language. And they say, my daughter, you can do this one, we can do this one. They said, okay, if I give you some amount of money, what will we be able to do with it? And I said, we'll do it, we'll buy this. So I started investing in rural women. Just my first group, my first mentor was an individual, a girl. In fact, now she's on my team. Then I started doing groups. So maybe groups of women, cooperative, given. I lost money quite a bit, I must confess. I did. And I was just doing all of that as pet project. So I set up the entity also because I wanted to put some sort of structure to it. I didn't want the women to feel like they were interacting with me as for me. I wanted them to feel like they were interacting with an entity and this is legal. You know, they needed to take the investment serious and they needed to also treat our inquiries. And we say, we want to see these reports, or when we call to say, Mama, what about this? What about that? I wanted them to open up more and not feel like it was just a personal favor.
Yeah.
And from 2020, COVID happened and I just did a random call. I said, let me just call my women, know how they're doing. And the things I heard were scary. I felt scary because you get on a call and you hear a woman whose kids are no longer in the house, by the way, because they've all gone to look for greener pastures, maybe working as domestic staff in the cities. And you're asking her, how's she doing? And she's telling you, I saved money with people we call informal finance. We have this sector of informal financial services provider. They're called Ajo, they're a group savings program and all of that. And she tells you, oh, I gave money to one of such entities and they vanished. I can't find them. And because the way those guys used to collect and disperse, usually is they go around. So they come to their shops, their farms, and they collect the money. And then when they want to release the money, they go around to give it back to them. So during COVID, no physical interaction, of course, a number of them vanished. So a lot of money in this economy actually has gone into thin air because of those kind of savings. So that's when I realized that a lot of the women I had supported were not even really banking with the formal systems I knew of. And I said, digging, asking questions. So the issue of our banking sector, banking industry here, are people, especially the baby boomers, they've seen a lot of failure, the banking industry collapse. They've experienced it, insurance companies collapsing. So there's no trust in those systems. And that's why the informal sector thrives, working with the non-traditional guys. So the traditional guys. And we then started doing literacy programs for them because my thesis was, if the woman understood the bank, if she understands how a banker thinks, then she would know how to engage. She would know the kind of questions to ask when they bring products to her. Mm-hmm. And if she can also do that, it means that the consumer base is becoming sophisticated. Then the banks and the microfinance institutions can develop better products for the women. So we started literacy programs. Last year, I said to God, okay, I want to train 100 women. All glory. Thanks to God for opportunities. I was able to do 172 women. We unlocked capital for a number of them. Affordable capital. So that's another big issue here. A lot of the low-income households, because they're high-risk, a banker, you know, their high-risk is unsecured lending. Anything, like they could vanish into thin air. So because of the risk implication, the interest rates are usually double digits, I mean, per month. So in a year, the average low-income woman in Nigeria can spend, if she was to borrow money all through the year, she can be paying as much as 100-120% per annum. So we started, yes, because they charge them per month. So in a year, if she borrowed every month, that means she's doing 100-120% in a year. So we started working with partners who, I would say, I had to actually convince some of them to say, take a bet on them. Then we designed models that could help minimize the default risk. And we also designed models that helped our partners meal off collection costs. So they didn't need to hear, when you serve low-income households and you provide what we call micro-loans, which is small $10, $20 you give to them, they repay in $10, $10,000. Say $30 to $100 give to them, they repay within 1 month to 3 months. Normally, you have to hire a collector to go into the market or wherever these women are to collect the money. And so we took off that burden off the partners and found a way for our women to remit it themselves thanks to mobile banking systems. So we have the point of sale machines, the POS machines that allows them, once you have a card, they can do all of that. So we've done that so far now. So far, we've been able to reach at least over 300 families and we've been thinking around how to deepen the literacy programs. Yeah, so this year now, we're going to have an NGO called the Aziza Development Foundation that will drive the outreaches, go into the communities, yes. And then Radiant Features will focus more on the impact investment side, mobilizing capital that can be dispersed to women in groups, cooperative trade unions, or medium-sized enterprises that do business with low-income women in those underserved communities. So that's the focus. And it sounds all fancy and all of that. Sometimes I think I'm in over my own head because it requires a lot of, like, you have to be on the field. You have to be talking to people. You have to be listening to them. And now we have to be engaging the political structures that they have there. So you have to talk to the politicians on ground. And it was a part of this that I avoided for so long. I didn't want to do that, but I'm realizing, we cannot say we're delivering real impact if we are also not engaging the leaders and the politicians on ground. We have to engage them. We have to find a way to get them to buy into the vision and also align into some of their promises to their people. To say, okay, you promised them this, that's what we're bringing to them. Can you allow us to thrive? Can you give us the right environment to function effectively? So, by the way, I never had it in mind to go for women. Sorry, I can talk a lot about this vision.
My next question would be like, why women only? Because poverty touches everybody.
Why women? Okay, good question. So like I said, my thesis in the beginning was, how do we improve the lives of low-income households? You see, it was everybody. And I had some crazy vision, like, how do I explain this to you in the context of the West? So take it, you have a flat tire. Yes. In the West, you drive into the car wash, they probably have the machine you can use to inflate and get it back, right? Or a gas station. And you just do it yourself. Okay, yeah. So here it's not like that. Those guys that would help your tires, fix your tires, they're usually on the street corners. So the picture I had was, how can I improve that guy who is on the street corner and get him to do business so nice that someone who went to high school wouldn't mind working with him and wouldn't feel that kind of job is beneath him, okay? And when I started to go out to engage, it turned out the only people that responded to me were women. That was just what happened. Every time I went into a community and I asked questions and I said, okay, please, I'm looking for like a group of farmers, where are they? And they say, oh, go down there, you know, they're speaking our native language, go down there. And then when you get there, you count. You see 3-4 elderly women are the ones on the field. When I did field projects in urban centers, in fact, in my neighborhood, and I spoke to my, we have what we call ward counselors. I don't know what you, I'm not sure, they're not your mayors. So just think of the guys below your mayors in your own setup. I spoke to such person here and she told me, she called me for a meeting that those people will be there. I got there, 90% of the people there were women. So it just turns out that every time I try to do a project for a community and I showed up there and somebody introduced me to the community and said, oh, everybody come out, the people who were coming out were women. Plus, research also actually supports that women are more credible, so they are more creditworthy. If you give a woman money, she's more likely going to repay you. While we also know by research that the men are more, they're confident, so they can approach a financial institution even without a so-called like solid hardcore business plan. Why the woman wouldn't do that? Third thing that then just sealed it for me, I came across a research that showed that women are more likely, in fact, one of them more likely in Africa, women, 95% of a woman's income goes back to the family. While for the men, only about 45 to 50, if I remember clearly, goes to the family.
Oh, wow.
Especially low income. And I actually know why, because I entered those communities. So the men, when you pay them, they earn wages, they can get involved in all sorts of social vices. They will go drinking, they will go watch soccer with his friends, they would hang out. So before he comes home, he spends most of it outside. While for the woman, the trader, who's just selling up to maybe $10 a week, a day. Yeah. Some of them do $10 a field a day. She takes the money back home. Once she's done in the market, she runs back home, takes out her $10, buys food, takes care of her kids. The child needs a book for school. She'll quickly buy it from that $10. So it just then solidified it. Oh, it looks as if after all, we're the ones that need it. And from what I've seen so far, if we invest in women, actually would help stabilize the homes. You would also help take a bit of pressure and burden off men who are truthfully trying, but just not finding a way forward. I've seen fathers in homes that are trying. I've seen one of my cluster heads, her husband lost his job and he's not been able to get a job since. She said, we funded her to start a small food joint in the neighborhood. Her husband had to support her there. So created a room, you know, for him to also at least find some sort of value. Like, okay, it's working there. It might just be helping her to serve people, engage men who come there to eat, but but he probably at least we're helping the family because he's responsible enough to still support his wife while he's still looking for a job. So that was how I ended up with women. And yeah, I'm totally committed to going all the way. Yeah. And I also saw from background growing up to when what happened to my father happened and we lost everything. It was my beyond my siblings and extended relatives stepping in. My mom had to carry more weight. That was the truth. I saw my mom take us to a gold market in Ibadan. They call the place Sabo. She sold all her jewelry. She sold glass bottles. You know, Coke bottles, the glass bottles?
Yes.
And my mom sold them. So you can sell them. You sell them to recycling companies.
Oh, wow. You guys started recycling companies back then.
Back then, yeah. So you sell the guys that wash and then take back to the company. They will not wash and take it back. Yeah. She sold that. Then she had a group they call cooperative. So they're like a local-based savings and investment group. They save together, they invest together, and they help one another. So that's how she was also able to really carry a lot of weight and support us and also support my father as much as she could. So those are the kind of scenarios I have seen that I think if we're able to create nicely, we can really, really serve low-income women, and we can hopefully, by the help of God, ultimately also improve their lives and then reduce poverty for our people.
Oh, beautiful. You've really grown into the world of community, and it's truly showcasing in the way that you get going about in your life and giving back to a community. It's huge, and it's such a big commitment with a family. You are married with children. How are you able to juggle all of that? Because there's some people, I'm sure, around the world, they want to do something like this. They're thinking maybe to, you know, engage community. They want to give back to the community. But I for sure know that it's a full-time commitment. How are you able to juggle all of that?
So one is, I have a supportive husband. Mm. If you remove my husband, I'm not sure I can stand. That's the truth. Also because when I started Radiant Features, I had one investor apart from myself, and it was my husband. It was the one I'll prepare a deck and I'll show him, say, see, my love, these women, if we do this, they can do this, we can do, I will do what I can do, you see, just to get me off his back a few times. So number one is, my husband is I have to acknowledge that's a big blessing in my life. If God didn't put him in my life, I'm not sure I can do what I'm doing. If I do it, I will struggle. It will be a big struggle. So the word would be, you have to be able to sell the vision to whoever is closest to you. So who's your normal support system? You know, if you have older kids, you know, you have to sell the vision to them, and you have to pray they understand and buy into it. So one is, my husband supports the vision. He's not a community person. If you take him into those rural communities, he will just be there smiling because he has a bit of language barriers when he wants to engage them. Two is, it's just not a terrain. It's not his zone.
It's for you. But he's there.
So he's just there to say, keep going, good job. Oh, you're tired. Yeah, sorry. You know, stuff like that. selling the vision to the people who are closest to us. Till date, most of the partners I have are my friends, like people that I know, that they know for me, like, for decades. I've always talked about low-income households. Since I was in university, I've always worked low-income. So the only reason why I didn't start this right after university was because I came into the labor force during the global economic recession of 2008. So I just panicked and I told myself, unemployment rate is high, debt's all over the place. There's no way on earth I'll go and do a non-profit or something that requires me to labor. You know, I didn't have the boldness then. I was so afraid. I was like, let me first take care of myself, then I'll figure it out. So the support helps. The other thing is just clarity of where you're trying to get them to. I think, so the vision is very clear to me. Because the vision is very clear, I don't have one way to do it. Tomorrow I can wake up and have another way to do it. So because my mind is flexible, since I knew exactly where I'm trying to head to, that helps me in terms of relationships. How do I engage people? So by the time I'm engaging someone, I'm quick to share. Once I sense that somebody carries a bit of the vision I have, I just strike. Immediately, I just share the fire. Like, this is what I'm also thinking. This is what I'm... So I didn't need to set this up before I even started really doing it. The other thing is, I have two full-time jobs.
Two full-time jobs?
Yes. So I would call it full-time because...
Like you guys said.
They're senior level roles. So they're senior level roles in two companies. But why I share that is, and I always tell the founders of those businesses that what they are doing is strategic to what I'm trying to achieve. So I don't see that work as work. I see it as an extension of what I'm trying to achieve. So for example, the number of time working with a tech company, we're doing learning and we're really servicing low-income households. It aligns with me. It aligns with my objective of low-income households. There's another company I work with. They're a private wealth management consulting firm. Someone say, oh, what are you doing in that space? And I'm like, oh, if I need to fund my women, who are the people that carry the cash? It's these people now. So you have to understand that world. So for me, everything is like this is a massive piece.
It aligns.
And yes, because everything aligns because I only have one question in my mind and I only have one desire for my community. I only have one desire for my women is how can I help them? How can they become better? How can I ensure that they have the resources they need to thrive? How can I ensure that they understand the value of letting their kids go to school rather than staying back at home to help them? Mm-hmm. You know, so because of that, it helps. So clarity of vision is key. The moment you're just clear, you don't need it big, just start small. I started with pet project. Like I can do two projects in a year and self-fund. I can invest in 5 women in a year using my personal savings. So I wasn't exposing anybody to my risk initially. But now, last year, I exposed few partners to the risk, so they had to bear. But the good thing is our repayment rate is still very good. So you just, with the support, with the community, and with the clarity of vision, it will help. Final piece for me is, especially for people who believe in God, if you carry the burden for a problem or a thing, I don't think it's normal. I think you're being called to serve that problem. You're being called to do something about it. Yeah. So you have to trust that if God has given you the burden, He has given you the vision, then He has given you the grace. And He's also giving you the resources. Because sometimes, you know, we think, I don't have the money. How am I going to do? My philosophy now is, if the burden is there, my job is to identify where am I supposed to go to. I know that the resources will show up, like things will align. So for me, God calls us and equips us. So, and that's God backing is actually more than enough. It's so more than enough to get us moving. Just do it and pace ourselves, you know. Don't compare yourself to anybody. You know, we're talking about that. Don't compare. Don't walk from a place of, this is what I have been called to do. I'm just going to do it. The grace that I have, I will execute. As I execute, greater grace, greater opportunity comes, I execute. It just keeps growing like that. Yeah.
Amen to that. I have to say amen to that because I can attest to God's calling. And it was a burden at one point, this Concrete Pastures. It was, because I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I had a lot of worry, just to anybody who has the burden, like my sister was saying. But God has pointed a lot of people, I have to say, that continue to bring people on this platform. At any point in this journey, someone always reaches out. You need to interview such and such. So no matter what your mission is that God has given you, He has people assigned to you that He's going to bring to make sure that you are successful in your journey. That is amazing, amazing, amazing. Wow. I even forgot my next question. Oh, wow. So how can people invest in your women, people who are listening and they feel passionate to invest into radiant futures of your women? How can people reach out or invest?
Okay, good question. Thank you. So this year we're setting up a social impact fund. The social impact fund is strictly really for individuals who believe that they are very interested in seeing Africa grow. Mm. While we are focusing on Nigeria, I'm looking at how can we find partners in other critical countries in Africa that also need the support, so we can just channel resources as much as we can. So with the social impact fund, we're not targeting a lot. That's not a lot of money to start this. So we're looking at, first of all, we're looking at $50,000, and that's because we're working with local currency, and it's really nothing. However, with that amount, we can easily support at least 5,000 women. That's the funny. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to set up the fund and then work with other local nonprofit organizations who are on the ground, including the nonprofit organization we have set up, which is Aziza Development, to identify communities that need resources. And our model is to invest in groups. So they have to be some sort of cluster or a cooperative. That way we can channel it. So these four people who are thinking of sustainable ways of doing their charity, you know, you don't want to do charity and just like the money just vanish. You want to do charity and say, oh, okay, so I gave $1,000, but the $2,000 is being cycled and more and more women can participate of the same fund. That's what we're trying to create here. Anyone who wants to participate can send us an email and just drop a line at hello@radiantfeaturesltd.com, or you can just reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn, Fumi Okubanjo. You can find me on IG. Just drop me a line. So our hope is with the social impact fund, we're not relying only on the microfinance institutions, because the truth is the cost of capital is still high. And sometimes some of those women just need a grant to create the base to just, you know, some of them just need like a non-interest loan just to create a base to start their journey. We cannot strictly fund the low-income households in Africa with microloans. It's keeping them in a cycle of debt, which is just deepening the poverty. That's what I've seen on ground. So we need
sufficient
capital to support them. Yeah, that's it.
I see. No, I'll have all your contacts in the show notes. So for anybody who is looking to invest into these amazing women, please reach out to Fumi in all of her contacts, whichever one is convenient for you, Instagram, LinkedIn, or her email. She's quick with responses, trust me, that I know.
When you're in my world, you're fast. You have to be fast.
Oh, trust me, I get it. Anything else is on your heart that you would like to share before I ask you the final question?
Sure, it's an interesting one that's been on my heart, really. And I'm probably going to share that, because a lot of times individuals go through tough time and we pray, we're asking, waiting. And what I'm discovering is we're seeking God's hand a lot, but we're not seeking his face. We're seeking, oh, can I get a new car? Can I buy a new house? Oh, I just need that job. And forgetting that all that seething of waiting for something to happen is actually deep in our ability to believe. All that seething of waiting and saying, God, I want this, God, I want this. What is just done till that thing happens is it's taught me how to ask and depend on God. So when we finally receive a car or the house, we're like, oh, I've gotten the car. And it's like, that was all of it. That's just it. It's just the car. But we've lost the vision of the journey of waiting, the journey of before I got to point B, while I was on point A and trying to get to B, I was just going through a cycle. I was repeating an activity. So either I was repeating consistently praying, or it's either I was consistently writing, journaling, or it's either I was consistently thinking and planning before I even finally executed. And then all those good or great habits that we've formed, we let it go and we just get to that point, you're like, oh, finally I have the car. And then you have to want something else again before you start it. So for me, something I just taken out like beginning of this year is faith journey, the journey of life. It's not so much in those mundane seasonal asks and desires. It's in who we become. So who do I become as I wait to finally build the social impact fund? Who do I become as I wait to see my kids finish from high school? You know, it's not so much of them graduating, but as I go on that journey, who am I becoming? And so for me, the faith work is becoming more of who we become rather than what are we getting. So if we're sharing our testimonies is, I was someone who was maybe I was praying for only 10 minutes, but now I know how to pray for 30 minutes or 1 hour because I was constantly asking for something. Or, I was someone who was journaling just once a month, but because I was trying to execute this project and I was constantly thinking about it and I was constantly writing, now I'm the person that can write, I can fill my journal out every day, you know? So for me, I think the last thing I would just really like to share, and the year could just move by quickly and we finish the year and we're saying, we're trying to like iterate ourselves and say, oh, 2024, what's up with me? I'm saying, oh, I grew my assets by this, I did this, I had a new house, and then you just forget that the For Me version, January 2024, is not the same human being that you are going to see in December 2024. Yeah. So the goal is, who do I become in December 2024? So am I going to be someone who's full of joy? Am I going to be somebody who's more confident? Am I going to be somebody who walks with her chin? I know she's just so grateful for what she has while she's still waiting for the things she desires. So I think that's not to drag this out for so long. That's really weird. Just have a walk of faith, a faith of a greater version, not in items. Items are mundane. And I know for someone that maybe is going through a lot of lack, it should sound like, oh, this person sounds like they have it all. No, I do not have it all. No, I don't. Still have a lot of faith that I want. Yeah. But it's just that the moment you see that the things we've waited and prayed for so much, you now finally have, and you see that our life and our journey cannot be about things. It just cannot be about things. It has to be greater than things. It has to be us knowing God, us knowing who we are, and then living it out, living the real identity out. How many, I want to buy a lot of shoes, right? How many places do you want to go to? My closet is full of shoes. Okay. How many places do you want to go to those shoes? I want 3 cars. Okay, it's nice. I want 10 houses. How many rooms are you going to sleep in? So we have to desire a self or a person or an identity that is greater than items and material, so that we can really love one another, enjoy life, just have peace.
Well said. This really fits.
Thank you.
With everything. No, it fits in with everything. Loving one another. I love it. I love it. So, last question for you, young lady. Have you found your concrete pastures?
In my head, I'm like, I found it. I think I have. It's the vision. It's very clear to me. Yes. And also when I'm in low-income neighborhoods, when I'm in underserved communities, I'm actually alive.
The joy you feel, right? The fulfillment. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. I feel it. Maybe today, this is my concrete posture. Do you understand? Maybe you ask me that same question 10 years' time, it might have shifted.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Today, more than ever before, I am convinced I have found my place. I am convinced I have found what is concrete, what is tangible, what is viable. Because when I think of concrete, I think of tangible. When I think of pastures, I think of viability. I think of green. I think of fruitfulness. So that's where I literally see those words, concrete passion, that thing that's tangible, real, meaningful to me. And I think I found it. And I found it first and foremost in God. And then it gave me the vision. So I have it. Yeah.
Wow. This has been an honor to have you on. I am so blessed to have had you here. Thank you for inspiring us. I am just oozing in blessings right now. I feel so happy. My heart is like so happy. I know why you came, because wow. I was told to call you here. So I'm so grateful that you said yes to coming on. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate you.
Thank you
for all you're doing. It's amazing. That's it on today's episode. It's truly an honor to serve each and every dreamer. Concrete Pastures now provides targeted services to dreamers coming to the US of A. We assist you to successfully integrate. We are here to support you as you write your new chapter. Kindly check out our services in the link tree. Until next time, keep dreaming.
Born and raised in the motherland, chasing a better life, story of an immigrant,
concrete pastures.